This episode with Dinah R. Fisher is the unofficial part 2 of 3, looking at the sociological side of collective action. The rub in all this is that Dinah's message is not dissimilar from Roger Hallam's, the unofficial part 1. She agrees that millions will likely die before the so-called anthro shift kicks in, and we get the cascade of structural policies we need to respond en masse to the crisis. The detail in all we discuss is in Dinah's new book, Saving Ourselves, From Climate Shocks to Climate Action, and the link to order is in the notes. If you want a close-up lens on the structural failures to date, coupled with the determination of those in power to ignore the loud and clear science, then please do consider buying my book, Cop Out. I've had great feedback from climate luminaries such as Sir David King, Bill McKibben, Alice Hill, Rupert Reed, and others. Thank you to all subscribers for your support. It's greatly received as it allows this series to continue. I get so many requests for interviews and it's getting harder to keep up. More supporters means more interviews that can be processed, so thank you again. Dinah, it's lovely to meet you. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. I want to start with a term that you use in the book, which is actually a major theme across the arc of it, which is anthro shift. Can you just quickly start by defining this idea of anthro shift and what it really means to us?
So anthro shift is basically a theory that I wrote with a colleague of mine, Andrew Jorgensen, in 2019. And the concept of the anthro shift builds on this idea of understanding the society environment in relation to understand when we see social change around the environment. And basically in the work that we wrote, but then I expanded on more recently, and then that's kind of the backbone of this book, as you said, is this notion that social change can happen and substantial social change can happen, which involves the reorientation of all the different social actors that make up our society. So that would be, you know, generally speaking, business, policy, civil society, the general public, right? And they all play a role in our society. And an anthro shift is when the roles that they play change in terms of how they change, in terms of decision-making, and in terms of the way they interact with the environment, the natural environment, that is. And so an anthro shift occurs when this social change happens, and the social change happens, or the anthro shift is the social change happening, but it is motivated by what we call a risk pivot, which is this general social conception of risk that is significant enough to motivate people to take action. And so the example that I use in the book and that I've used in my previous work is if we think about during the beginning of the COVID pandemic, when people got to the point where they felt so concerned about getting sick or even dying that they basically were willing to take really very substantial action in their own individual lives, but also decision makers, businesses, the governments around the world all shut the world down, right? And that was an anthro shift. The world changed substantially. One of two components of the anthro shift that I think are really important is one is that the anthro shift is driven by risk, which I already mentioned. But the other one is that it's what we call multi-directional. And that is that the different social actors can configure themselves to be more progressive around climate or progressive around the environment to protect it more. But then they can also shift back. And we've seen many examples of that. I mean, much more on the kind of state level or even local levels. For example, in the United States, we've seen a lot of this happen after an extreme event, Hurricane Sandy, Hurricane Katrina. But there are examples of this after fires all over the world. When there are fires after that, frequently, there is this sense of risk that is driven by the threat, the environmental threat, that drives policymakers to open up what we call windows of opportunity for social change. What the book talks about is how the window has to get wide enough because people have to feel so much risk personally due to climate change that they're willing to be open to and push for the kind of social change that is needed. And what I talk about in the book is the fact that we really need systemic changes, as many scientists have been, you know, screaming about from the rooftops at this point, in terms of transitioning away from fossil fuels.
It seems like pre-pandemic, there were a couple of points where it did feel that we were going through this sort of anthro shift, but then we sort of reverted back. There was a lot of momentum and then it just dissipated. Can you just give us a quick overview of why you think that happens in the cases of the, you know, the last decade, but also what it does to the morale and the people involved.
Those are very good points. I mean, so first of all, we see some examples of when the world looked like it was starting to move forward quite aggressively around climate change. And I suppose the Paris Agreement would be a good example. And many countries really got in line and started thinking about taking the steps needed. But it was, you know, but in the end, the steps that were taken were insufficient to get us where we need to go, even to meet the commitments of the Paris Agreement, the initial ones, let alone to get us to, you know, stop global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius, which we've surpassed at this point, right? And I think that the way that I talk about it in the book and the way that I think about it in my work is that when this kind of social change happens, you see there are those that want to maintain business as usual. And in this case, it's very much the entire complex that is around fossil fuel interests that are pushing against shifting away from fossil fuels. I mean, we see some great examples of that recently. If we look at the discussions that happened at the most recent round of the climate negotiations, where countries were pushing for agreement and wording to commit to a fossil fuel phase out, and we saw interest pushing back against that. And those tend to be what we were forced to call them in the IPCC, these vested interests, which basically means fossil fuel interests. But you know, we were forced there not to actually say that. And in both those cases, what you see is those actors that are going to be affected by the types of social changes that an anthroshift makes, they're going to push against it. So there needs to be enough of a sense of risk within the general public, among the general public, within business and the state, to be willing to go past it, even though there's going to be resistance. I mean, think about during the beginning of COVID, how long did it take for countries who saw they saw the wave of disease coming, and it took a while for people to be willing to, you know, stop social mixing and to shut schools down and to shut, you know, public transit down, et cetera, and so forth. And that was all due to this heightened risk. And so what we're seeing is this question, and people have asked me this, I don't know exactly what level of risk we need. What I do know is we need to have such a high level of risk that people recognize in their daily lives that the world has to change, because otherwise many parts of the world will become uninhabitable. Yep. And we're starting to have awareness about that, but we're also starting to see these vested interests push back quite substantially.
I was asking about what it does to the morale of people when it dissipates.
I think that those who are pushing for social change can become really disheartened and lose their motivation. It can be very demobilizing for a movement for them to see social change that they think is going to be super effective to find that it's not. I mean, I'll take an example right now is that we have this pause that the Biden administration has announced against natural gas exports, right? And expanding out natural gas exports. So it's not stopping current exports, but rather building more sites for that. The climate movement has announced that this is a huge win. And celebrated, I mean, huge celebrations across all different sectors of the movement, from the more radical folks to those who are much more what we call the big greens, these very kind of institutional actors. Unfortunately, this pause that the administration has announced is very much a temporary decision, and there's no commitment for long-term pausing or stopping of expansion of fossil fuel extraction and exportation. And what's going to be really unfortunate is that given the work that I've done over, you know, 25 years of studying American climate policies and American energy policy, it will be very, very, very unlikely that this pause will be formalized. Instead, what we're going to see is a pause until after the election, and then either we have new President Trump in his second term who's going to basically decimate all climate policies in the United States, or we're going to have a second President Biden term, and I'm expecting that he is going to go back and, you know, open back up more expansion, because he has always been an all-of-the-above energy policy president. Either way, when that happens, after all these people mobilized and celebrated, it's going to be extremely disheartening. And some people will either give up on the movement or they're going to radicalize. Those are the two options. And I think that given that the climate crisis is going to continue to get worse, most of them are going to radicalize.
That was my next point, because last year we saw just so much unprecedented stuff in Europe, in places like Greece and Libya, serious destruction, life threats, loss of farmland, crops, all the rest of it. And even as we're talking now, California is getting bashed, Chile's on fire, Canada's been burning through the winter. These kinds of, it's just insane. And earlier you said, well, it's good. We don't know what quite level of risk we're going to need before people actually feel threatened. When you come to this moment we're at now, in a way, it seems like the moderates are sitting back and the radicals are just going more radical. Does that make sense? Is that a fair point?
What we have right now is we have what I call the incrementalists. Those are the people who really believe in the policymaking process. And, this incremental political change can get us where we need to go. I think they're really leaning into this notion that incrementalism and multilateralism can work. But we are now 30-some years into the climate regime. I mean, the climate regime started in 1992, and we're nowhere near where we need to go. So I think that we have this incrementalist group that is holding back and being somewhat critical to the radical flank, which is starting to recognize that much more radical tactics are needed. But I think that the incremental group is going to start to wane as more and more people are personally affected by the climate crisis. I mean, in the past year, you're right, we've seen so many parts of the world that are starting to experience these extremes. I mean, we had parts of the United States, continental United States, like in Arizona, where it was uninhabitable for certain periods of time without air conditioning. That's going to continue, it's going to expand, and more people will start to recognize that we need to take action. And so then the question is, are there tools in everybody's toolbox to take that kind of action and push for social change in a way that gets us where we need to go in terms of systemic change within the current political system? And I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question, which a lot of people don't want to talk about. And certainly those folks who are leading these very, mainstream groups that are working within the political system as insiders, who have access to power that way are not really comfortable thinking about it because, they may not have the same kind of power in the future and they get their power from supporting the system.
And looking at it through the UK lens, I mean, the radical side, it requires not just effort, but energy, momentum, courage. And they're up against an increasingly authoritarian state, which is now locking them up. They're restricting their rights in the courtroom, etc.
We see something very similar happening in the United States. We're a little behind you, but it's happening all over for sure. But you realize that those steps, those draconian steps, that's when power is starting to feel threatened. And it is an indication that those in power recognize that the people who are starting to put pressure on them are starting to gain traction. But it unfortunately is a necessary stage in a social movement.
So you think it's part of the mechanism, it's part of the phase change in a way.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the literature on social movements, it's very clear about how repression is a very common and natural response to social movements that are becoming more appealing to the masses. And usually those movements, as they grow, there are some in the movement that start to push more aggressively and more confrontationally. And those in power start to feel threatened by that. And to maintain power, they push back using repression. I mean, they use all the tools they can because otherwise they lose their legitimacy and either have to change their policies substantially or they leave power, right? They lose. They
Okay.
can lose politically, they can lose, there are many different mechanisms that you can use for that.
Okay. And there was one point in the book, and this is more about you yourself in doing this, on a personal level. What's your boundary between doing the research? Because you do say, we're out amongst the protesters, the activists, asking questions, doing surveys. And it's vital that you're doing it, but what's the boundary between you wanting to get stuck in and sort of kick the movement into a higher gear? You use the reference to the article with the clapping for Tinkerbell. That was the bit that I was referring to.
Piece. I mean, so basically, I have always been, I'm a social scientist. I'm very much empirically focused. And I believe very strongly that when I am in the streets collecting data, I am there as a researcher. And I think it's valuable and important for me to have that objectivity of being somebody studying the people in the crowd rather than being the participant observer, because it's very hard for me to collect the kind of data that I collect if I'm actually one of the crowd. Now, that doesn't mean I don't sympathize with people in the crowd, but it's very important for me to maintain that. So if I go out to participate in a protest, I do so not while I'm collecting data. And so when I go out and survey and protest, I go out with research teams. We have to use a very structured sampling procedure so that we get a full sample that is randomly selected throughout the crowd. And all of that requires that we have at least some, level of distance from what's going on in the crowd. Regarding the Clapping for Tinkerbell piece, it was based on frustration with the degree to which policymakers and also activists were very much kind of leaning into policy measures that were never going to work. And that paper was originally conceived while we were sitting at the cafe at the Library of Congress, which is right next to the Supreme Court. And it was after the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade was leaked. And I was sitting with my colleague and my co-author on the piece, and we were just chatting about how strange it was, because it was also at the same time that the Build Back Better Act, which was the efforts that the Biden administration originally conceived of to address climate change, was dying in the Congress. And we were just talking about these two different struggles for maintaining reproductive rights and also to address climate change, and the ways that the activists and kind of the civil society communities were clapping at Tinkerbell and supporting these efforts that were not going to get anywhere near where they needed to go. And in the process of that time, one, Build Back Better had died, but then there was this new bill that came out that supports both fossil fuel expansion along with clean energy investment. That's called the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, which, is a great example of incremental politics, but it is there's lots of evidence showing how it is both expanding clean energy and also expanding fossil fuel extraction in the United States simultaneously. And at the same time, people were all complaining about the lack of reproductive rights or the threat to reproductive rights, but nobody stopped or tried to use any useful political tools they could to stop overturning Roe v. Wade in the United States. And so now we no longer have the right to an abortion that is built into the political system. So we were motivated to write about it and criticize the way that movements and, civil society groups more broadly were taking on these challenges in ways that were never going to get to where they wanted to go. And it was just so frustrating. And that's why we said they were clapping for Tinkerbell.
It is almost like an intervention. You're saying if you're going to protest and get involved in this.
Do it in a way that matters. Have some teeth to you. I mean, and I'm not saying that it needs to be violent or even needs to be disruptive, but it needs to target opportunities of political change, right? I mean, as for example, there was this one protest recently that was announced in the United States after all the decisions were made and investment in this Mountain Valley Pipeline, which was Joe Manchin's. The rule for passing the Inflation Reduction Act was that he got to have this Mountain Valley Pipeline constructed. And all of these activists decided, after that was decided, all the policies were already done. They were going to have a protest. And just this amazing symbolic waste of everybody's time where people come out and protest a decision that's already made. You can't overturn a policy once it's already passed.
Yeah, totally. Okay, I just want to come back to this idea of the big climate shock that could create the sort of anthro shift. The similar point was made by Roger Hallam in an interview we did recently, where he was sort of saying, several million people dying will be that event. But when we looked at what happened in Pakistan, a couple of years ago, and then we look at Libya, where I don't even know what the death toll or missing people ended up being, but it was kind of brushed aside. Acapulco wasn't even really on the news in Europe because we don't seem to respond to them unless they're right in front of us, literally a few kilometers away. Is there not another way to get around this or to even head it off? Because we know that these things are coming to all of us eventually.
I think that, quite frankly, without a personal visceral experience of a climate shock, I think it's hard to fathom the level of mobilization that's necessary. So I mean, even the Secretary General of the United Nations said we will be faced with, what did he say, 1,000 Pakistans if we don't do something. And I don't think we need 1,000 Pakistans, but I think that we need to see that kind of climate shock happening around the world simultaneously where people feel the risk before we see the mobilization. Now, the way to limit that is more organizational infrastructure that's in place to push for social change. And the only place that's going to come from is from the civil society sector, because we've given businesses and policymakers, you know, 30 some years now to make the changes themselves. So unless this silver bullet is found, I mean, for example, today there's a big meeting going on here in DC around carbon capture and storage and carbon removal. I mean, hey, if they figure that whole thing out and the technology all of a sudden is scalable, that could be a wonderful dream. But I believe in living in the real world. And so instead, I think that we need to understand that nobody's coming to save us. We're going to have to save ourselves. But I mean, I remember when we started thinking about this, and the whole discussion was about our concern for the polar bear and the polar ice caps. And at that point, there was this argument that we should take the precautionary principle and make policy change in our behaviors and decisions because we were worried about what might happen. Well, the science is irrefutable at this point. It's been that way for quite some time, and we still don't see the policy changes that are needed. And so what that basically tells me is that it's going to take more. And that's where the anthroship comes in, is that at what level do we need to see these kinds of shocks? And the only thing that I can say in response is that I think that an expectation that we'll see a global shift, well, if we have to get to that point, and I think Roger's probably right, we're talking about millions of lives lost around the world. I think that what's more likely and what I hope for instead is that we're going to see discrete climate shocks that are quite severe happening around the world that push for institutions at the local level, or at least at the state level, to make changes, and there will be a cascading effect of policies coming from different countries. I think it's possible. I hope it's likely. And I think that that will definitely have to be driven by places where a civil society sector is in place to help, as I talk about in the last chapter of the book, to help build solidarity across different interests that include labor, to capitalize on the shocks that people experience, as well as the repression and the ways that repression leads to moral shocks against activists, and the violence against activists, that is. And then finally, the ways that local community groups can actually build and cultivate resilience, and that is social and environmental resilience, that will help make a community capable of withstanding a climate shock, right? I mean, we've seen all these examples, different places where they're hit with these extreme events. And in some places, people move and they just fall apart and all these people are unhoused and there's no support. And other places, there's this social net in place to support, rebuild, and adapt. And, you know, we all want to be the second place, right? We want to be the place that has that capacity. If there's enough of that, that can also push for the kinds of changes we need. And that's what I hope for.
And do you think that those, what you've just outlined, those three points, they also form a sort of structure underneath the activism that kind of supports it as it, you know, you get these spikes of activity, keeps the momentum?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's really important. I think of that as, you know, we talk about that as organizational infrastructure. I mean, one of the challenges right now is that within the climate movement, we see a lot of groups that are what I call the shockers, that are working to use actions to elicit shock from the general public and get media attention. And while that's very valuable for helping to raise awareness about the issue, it's not building a lot of there, and we're going to need there to be, I don't want to keep saying there, we need there to be real infrastructure in place, because this isn't just about raising awareness, it's also about being prepared for the kinds of shocks that are coming. You know, I'm a social scientist, but I believe in my colleagues in the natural sciences that have been writing and screaming from the rooftops about the types of ecological changes that are coming due to the outrageous warming waters that we see, the melting ice caps, these shifts in the weather patterns that are coming because of increased, you know, temperatures, the warming waters, which basically add more vapor into the atmosphere, which is why we see these atmospheric rivers hitting places like California right now. I mean, they had 12 inches of rain yesterday. It's almost like a year in a day of what they're used to. So we're going to see mudslides. I mean, the amount of devastation we're probably going to see there when the cloud's part is going to be quite substantial. And I think that we need to take the lead from the natural scientists and think socially about how we're going to prepare ourselves for what's coming, because we're clearly not doing anything to stop it.
This is really to end on the COP process. And you do mention in the book that you became disillusioned with it. And I think I've sort of had my fill of it from Paris to the UAE. But in Paris, there was this feeling that the political elites were going to save us. That was the Paris Agreement.
We had that feeling in Kyoto. We had that feeling in Copenhagen. We had that feeling in The Hague. Just so you know, Paris was the last straw for me. But yes, it's true. At all those, they were going to save us. The political elite would do it. I mean, it's hard to imagine that we'll see out of these petro states that are leading now the climate negotiations that anybody's going to come to save us. OPEC's not going to come save us, I don't think.
And it felt like over the years, until you got to Glasgow, it was like the agency was moving away from the blue zone to the activist zone. In Glasgow, you really got a sense outside that the police were defending the perimeter, that the protesters were there. You couldn't miss them. You could not hear them. The chanting was constant. I mean, it was really impressive to experience. And then suddenly,
you weren't in Copenhagen, were you? Where the billy clubs were everywhere and the protesters. I mean, NGOs were kicked out of the negotiations, and protesters were being beaten up on the streets. I mean, it was remarkable. But so this, you know, Glasgow wasn't the first time that happened. But I mean, the regime really changed and became much less permeable to civil society and open to civil society participation.
Well, I was just going to say, wait till you get to Egypt and then to the UAE. Yeah. And, you know, you're going into the COP in the UAE and you're watching gas flaring from a refinery. There's protesters, they're in a little licensed pen somewhere inside the blue zone. And it's a feeling that adds to this level of a distance from the talks. So there's no pressure on the people inside. There's thousands of lobbyists, but there's no protesters. It's obviously, you know, the mask has slipped from the COP. You've got fossil fuel bosses. It's a zombie industry we don't want, but it's in control. Is there an opportunity for the global climate movement to apply pressure from this distance? Because, you know, the British government are going there after signing loads of deals. Same in America, same in Canada, same in Norway, Australia, EU, you know, you name it.
So, I mean, I actually when I started out my career, some of my early papers were all about how comparisons between the climate regime and the world trade regime and the degree to which the climate regime was so much more open to civil society and much more legitimate, transparent, right? I mean, that was one of my early papers. And it's not the case anymore. So first of all, I mean, and I also, having been in this world and studied this for this many years now, I think that we are much better equipped for thinking about social change coming from the ground up than we are thinking about starting at the international level, because it's so much harder to have an effect there because that system is so embedded in capital and embedded in privilege, in terms of privileged access to the fossil fuel resources. I think it makes a lot more sense to start at the grassroots and start by targeting states that don't, for example, states that don't extract fossil fuels and instead import them. They're more open to considering the kinds of resources that they can build their countries around and expand their countries around. But I think that it's just easier to make social change locally. And so, I mean, I was one of the people who last year, before Egypt, I actually was in the media saying that I think anybody who really cares about climate change, who was going as a civil society, you know, as an NGO observer, should stay home. I mean, if you really care about the climate crisis, the idea of flying to the other side of the world and sitting in a room with people, I mean, for me, if I were to go, I would go to these side events where people who basically live and work in the same city where I am would be on a panel. And the idea that that is a valuable way for me to spend my time and spend the resources I have, it's just hard to imagine. And I know some people did not like that I said that, but I mean, it's a farce right now. And it's just performative practice of making it look like decision makers are making progress when they're just running in place or even going backwards, perhaps. So I just think we shouldn't legitimize it by going. I think instead we should focus at the local level. We should focus on our nation states It's a lot easier to build power to push against change. And also, if the process through which people rise up is climate shock, which I do believe that that's probably the best way we're going to see people rising up, it is much easier to see that in a locality where the climate shock is being experienced rather than as some sort of global collective. And then it's like, okay, well, this stuff happened in Maui, and this stuff happened in Pakistan, and this stuff happened in Greece. But then you have, but there's a global regime there. Whereas if you're looking at the nation state level, the experience of these shocks can have much more impact at the national level.
So we won't see you in Azerbaijan.
You will certainly not see me there.
Okay. Well, look, thank you very much. It's been fantastic to speak to you and read your book as well. It's been very instructive. It sort of takes us up to where we are and what the thing kind of things we need to be doing. So great.
Thank you.